the center of the universe. This goes back to knowledge and belief. Anybody from Butte knows Butte is the center of the universe. The rest of you just believe it. That's why the title of this thing is The View from the Center of the Universe, because that's where I live. Climate change and electric energy markets. First thing you need to realize is, in reality, the only impact that electric markets can have on climate change and greenhouse gases is to reduce generation levels on fossil fuel. No magic to that, but that's what it is. The question simply then becomes, how do we accomplish that? What can the electric utility industry, whether regulated or unregulated or public, what can it do to reduce the need to generate on fossil fuels? And that's what we're going to talk about. There are three basic tools that they have, that we have. The first is called demand response. And demand response, in the good old days, they used to call it load shedding. So if your need for power starts to grow, one of the alternatives, instead of adding generation, is simply to tell someone, okay, we're going to cut you. And that it was much simpler to do way back when, because there were a lot of industrial customers who would get a preferential rate to be interruptible. So they could stop their industrial process, quit taking that energy. The mines in Butte used to do that. They would identify certain portions of their process that could be shut down in order to avoid adding more generation. It's more difficult to do these days because so much of process is driven by instrumentation, computers, and all that sort of stuff. And so demand response tends to be more difficult. One of the things that they do use for demand response are big refrigeration loads. You know, theoretically, if you're running a big refrigeration load, then if you shut that off for a couple of hours and you've got insulation, it's not going to cost you a lot. And so one of the places they find demand response is in refrigeration loads. But now it's difficult to do that because there just aren't that many loads out there that people are willing to say, go ahead, stop my process, we'll go. So there's out there, but they're small bites of the apple. If you look at it, it's a small, small bite. The other trick that we use for demand response, and it's not really a trick, it's time of use metering. And the idea there is, okay, if you want to run your wash machine or your dishwasher or your TV, whatever the item is, if you run it in peak hours, we're going to charge you an arm and a leg. If you run it in off-peak hours, we'll make the energy available to do that much cheaper. The problem is with that is that there are a lot of people who sign up for that. They say, you know, this is like, that sounds like a good idea to me, and I have a social conscience, and so I want to do that. And then 2 weeks later, they call up and they're saying, I want to run my damn wash machine when I want to run my wash machine. Take me off the program. So they have a very thin social conscience. And so although they have those kinds of programs, again, the benefit for those is relatively small. So on the demand side, it exists, but it's small. Next, efficiency. And that in utility parlance, that gives you avoided resources. So for every megawatt that I save through energy efficiency, then it's a megawatt that I don't have to build at some point in the future. And there are 1,000 different ways they try to do this. Energy efficient windows, energy efficient refrigerators, energy efficient, the list goes on and on and on. And again, these are all incremental savings. There are two issues to that are associated that make it difficult from a pure efficiency standpoint in today's energy market. Energy today, relative to the last 20 years, is actually fairly inexpensive compared to what the cost of insulation and triple pane windows and all that is. So the payback, if you make the investment in insulation and energy efficiency, the payback tends to be years. Utility regulators have difficulty letting utilities recover costs associated with implementing efficiency systems because the payback is so long. So that's the first problem. The second problem is the people who could really truly benefit from energy efficiency measures oftentimes simply don't have the money to put into home insulation and windows and all of that sort of thing. You see programs like HRDC go around and try to do low-income weatherization programs. Does two things. One, makes their energy bills less expensive, but number two, it also adds to the reduction, the avoided cost, the avoided resource. So again, all of that, that's a megawatt or a million BTU of gas we don't have to burn in the future. Now comes the big kahuna, LED lights. LED lighting, by and large, represents about 20% of utilities load. In Montana, their peak's roughly 1,800 megawatts. Lighting, you can say, is about 360 megawatts. California, where their average load is 60,000 megawatts, lighting represents about 12,000 megawatts. LED lights are anywhere from 50 to 70% of the energy of an incandescent bulb. So again, the real gift for me is I'm not very smart, so I have to do simple math. So let's say it's 1,000 megawatts of lighting load, and we convert everything to LEDs at 50% less energy usage. We just got ourselves 500 megawatts. That's a big number. That's a huge number. There's other benefits associated with LED lighting as well. It doesn't add to the heating load. I happen to have an ownership interest in a power plant in Butte. A year ago, we converted all of our lighting to LEDs. And that's the office lighting, the industrial engine hall lighting, all of that got converted to LEDs. The oddest thing happened the first winter after we did that. Obviously, our lighting bill went down substantially. But the other thing that we noticed, it was a winter day and they happened not to be running the plant. And we walked in, and that plant's been running for 14 years. We walk in and we've got little space heaters on the wall. For 14 years, we thought they were ornamental. And that was generated because of the high bay sodium vapor lights. The heat they threw off kept that entire building warm. Suddenly, we walk in one day, it's 30 or 40 below, and one of those space heaters was running. It's the first time in 14 years we'd ever seen that. So that gives you a sense of what kind of heat that lighting generates. So lighting from energy efficiency, that's the elephant in the room. That is the thing that will generate the biggest impact on resource additions. And the benefit of that is, and I wish I could say it was the lighting industry, but it's not, the television industry. When they started going after LED technology, they drove the cost of that technology down. And now LED lights are available, and they're actually a pretty reasonable price. One of my daughters is actually in the DSM business, and 4 years ago, she sent me a little story on LED lighting and said, keep your eyes on this. This is going to change this industry. Turns out she was right. So that, then I knew for sure she was related to her mother. Now, non-emitting resources. So, what are they? Hydro is the first one. And we all talk about, let's talk about the dams in Great Falls. They're what are called run-of-river resources. So the energy that's available from those dams, the hydro system in Montana, in fact, all of it except for Kerr, are basically run-of-river dams. You get electricity out of them when there's water. When there's not, no electricity. So when there's water, they're firm energy, but they're really referred to as non-firm energy because year in and year out, you can't say for certain, I'm going to get this much energy out of these facilities over the course of a year. Pretend you own a utility for a second. Your obligation is to serve. Imagine, if you will, that people go turn on their lights and nothing happens. You're not going to have a very good dinner hour. If that happens often enough, you're not going to have a job. And so from a utility perspective, the big issue for me is I need firm energy. I have to know that when people flip those lights, that there's going to be something there so that the lights come on. And so the further you get away from firm energy or firm capacity, the shakier they get. So run-of-river is non-firm energy. Then you have storage, which is firm capacity and energy. The difference is, and you probably all know this, capacity is the ability to generate electricity, and energy is the actual electricity itself. So if I have a storage facility like Kerr Dam, then I've got water sitting there, and if I need electricity, basically, I open the penstocks a little more and generate a little more electricity. Even this has changed because way back when, in the Bonneville system is a good example, they used to just generate as they needed, and they did what they called load following, because as you can imagine, any utility anywhere, if the load is 1,800 megawatts, it doesn't sit at 1,800 megawatts. It bounces around 1,800 megawatts, but it's never at that point for anything more than a millisecond. And so you have resources that are called load following. As the load goes up, these things generate more. As the load goes down, they generate less. And they used to do all this load following with hydro resources. Then they found out that basically fluctuating river systems like that had a tremendous impact on fish and wildlife and habitat and all of that, and recreational users as well. Because one day you're sitting there, the lake levels it, you know, your dock's right outside your cabin door. The next day you walk out and your dock's on dry ground. So they've even changed the way that those systems can operate. But they do like storage facilities because firm capacity, firm energy. In response to this need for renewable resources, people have developed what they call pumped storage projects. And basically the idea here is pretty simple. What you're doing is, I'll use my Goldman Sachs word, you're performing arbitrage between peak and off-peak prices. So at night, power is 10 bucks. So when power is 10 bucks, I can take these pumps and lift the water out of my low reservoir and use that energy and pump it up to a higher reservoir. Great. Then when peak hours come, I can take that energy where the peak price is now $50, $100, $200, and now instead of pumps, they're generators. And so now I take that water and drain it from the high reservoir into the lower reservoir, generate all that peak energy, and put money in my pocket. But again, I haven't emitted any greenhouse gas in doing all of this. I've just played the differential between the peak and the off-peak markets Arbitrage, my word of the week. Nuclear powers, in absolute isolation, if you wanted the most flexible, best resource you can get for no greenhouse gas, you'd build nuclear. You would. That, and again, I'm just looking at the energy side of the equation. It's the best. It can respond very quickly. You can run baseload. You can run peaking. You know, it responds instantaneously almost. From a pure energy perspective, we should be building new plants left and right. There's that little messy issue about 20,000-year half-lives and nuclear waste and all of that. But ignoring that, if you would, it's a great resource for greenhouse gas emissions. The problem is you've got the operational risk, waste, transport, storage, all of that. And so it's really not a viable option. There are companies to this day who are looking at smaller size nuclear facilities to address some of the issues associated with non-greenhouse gas. I would be stunned if they got to first base, but a lot of things surprise me. But don't think for a minute that people don't consider this, because they do. You have battery storage. Batteries, firm energy, firm capacity, but they're very short duration. And they have low energy density. What I mean by energy density is how much land does it take to generate, you know, pick whether it's a megawatt or 5 megawatts or 500 megawatts. How much land does it take? Batteries have very short duration and very low energy density. If I want to get the power plant in Butte is 50 megawatts and it's housed inside a 100 foot by 300 foot building. It would take probably 10 to 20 times that much land to generate the same amount of electricity with batteries. And that's the game. You have to charge it. And the ratio of batteries is about 1.4 to 1. So for every hour I run the thing, I've got to charge it for about 1.4 hours. And so that takes resources, whether it be wind, solar, coal, whatever, but you have to charge that battery.
Sure.
The other thing that impacts the life of the battery is how often do you run that cycle? A lot of money, and you'll see some numbers here in a minute, that for me demonstrate how much work the battery world has to do. A lot of people are spending time and energy and money trying to solve that puzzle. And eventually they'll get there. But for now, it's, I think battery technology by and large is sexy, if that's the appropriate word. People want to say, look, I'm doing what I can. Look, I've installed some batteries. Okay, but you know, from a practical standpoint, they simply don't do a lot for you.
Yeah.
Good in theory, not so much in practice. As the technology moves and they reduce that 1.41 ratio and they find a way to increase the energy density, then I'm one of the people who happen to think, I used to say in my lifetime, but as I get closer to the end, that's probably a pretty broad statement. Sometime in the next 20 years, you're going to see battery technology, I think, move in light years in order to accomplish that. You see, the other two are geothermal and biomass. Geothermal, difficult to size them and land them, and all the conditions have to be right to locate a geothermal facility. And I've got some numbers here in a minute. It shows you the pervasiveness of the different technologies, and that'll tell you a lot. Biomass, the big problem, I actually worked on a couple of biomass projects. And biomass projects are difficult, very difficult. One, you've got feedstock issues. You know, it's easy to say we're going to burn wood. When a 20 megawatt biomass facility burns 70 tons of wood a day, and I gotta say it, wood doesn't grow on trees. You know, you gotta truck that stuff in. You've gotta load it on semis and get it there. And so here's it's a semi, 5 tons. Here's your neighbor sitting there, and they're wheeling 70 tons of wood in a day. The NIMBY deal takes hold pretty quick. So wood, although it's good in theory, it's difficult in practice. So again, now we move to the elephants in the room. Wind and solar. The two big issues from a utility perspective, remember now, you're the head of the utility. What you have to have is, you have to have power that you know is going to be there. That's your job. The problem with wind and solar from a utility planning perspective is they're called intermittent resources, or it's non-firm energy. And I can give you an example. I was talking to a guy in SMUD a while back. SMUD is the Sacramento Municipal Utility District. And he said, he was telling me, and I found it actually fascinating, which shows you how boring my life is. They have no net load growth. If they look at their load forecasting, there is no net load growth in SMUD's district. But everywhere you go, there's new construction. Everywhere. And he said, what the difference is all this new construction is highly energy efficient, rooftop solar, rooftop wind, they do all the steps that you would want them to do. And he said, it all works out great until suddenly the sun goes behind a cloud or the wind stops blowing. And suddenly they will see 500 and 600 megawatt swings in 3 minutes. So you're sitting there with all of these rooftop solar and wind projects going, the wind stops or the sun goes down, and suddenly, from a utility perspective, you're 600 megawatts short. That's a big number. And so it creates those kinds of issues for utility, and we'll go into this a little bit more. Generally, PV solar and wind, they also have low energy density. So again, if I'm going to generate 5 megawatts of electricity with wind or PV solar, the back of the envelope number is it takes about 5 acres to generate 1 megawatt. Plus or minus, depending on location and radiation factors and all that. But generally you can figure 5 acres a megawatt. I did a quick calculation, I don't remember, but if I was going to power the world with wind and solar, if you look at all the energy consumption, we only have to cover the world 4 times with PV, solar, and wind projects to provide all the energy that's needed. So that tells you about the energy density of those resources. Valuable resources, but low energy density. These technologies are much more cost competitive today because prices have dropped. One of the big reasons prices have dropped, and you'll see this on these numbers. I'm trying to give you something to look forward to, these numbers. The big reason that PV solar prices have dropped so much is China. China started manufacturing PV solar and literally drove the bottom out of price. So from an installer's perspective, suddenly we had where PV solar used to cost $3,000 to $4,000 a kilowatt to install, $3 to $4 million a megawatt. Now we're seeing numbers in the $1,000, $1,200 a kilowatt. So it's dropped it by a factor of 3 or more. The problem is when you get huge solar, and strap yourself in, kids, we're getting close to the numbers. When you have these huge installed bases of PV, solar, and wind, then from now you're the utility guy again, here you've got 25 or 30% of your system load is driven by these intermittent resources. What do you do? How do you handle that issue? System operation impacts. We're going to talk about California because California, again, is the gorilla in the room. I think everyone here understands the West is on a single grid system. So everything basically from Colorado west, we're all interconnected on the electric. So whatever happens in California can impact us. Whatever happens here can impact California, Colorado, Arizona, on and on it goes. But the fact of the matter is, we're all on a single interconnected system. The big gorilla in that room right now is California. California has about 80,000 megawatts of total installed capacity. Again, you know, to make the math easy, let's say that Montana's 2,000 megawatts. So basically, they're 40 times the size we are. If you wonder what technologies are driving the renewable energy market right now, just take a look at the installed number of megawatts. And that tells you where the money is in renewable technologies. PV solar, and it didn't, you know, 5 years ago, this number was very different. But PV solar now is, you know, 12,000 megawatts of the installed capacity. Look at batteries, biofuels, geothermal, and small hydro. They're small pieces of that whole renewable technology. And again, this number, this 22.5, does in fact represent 25 to 30% of generally the peak demand in California. So that is a lot of installed capacity. It's a lot of energy. And it's actually had a very interesting effect on the energy markets in California. Energy markets in California now operate on what is called a duck curve. And historically, the way the load curve went is you had X amount of generation online starting at 4 o'clock in the morning. And then as people started to get up and turn on their stuff, the demand went up and up and up. And it was generally on its peak between, say, noon, 1 o'clock, and 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening, and then it started to trail off again. That's how it worked for years and years and years. And utility people could plan on that, and they could sleep well at night because that's how it was going to work. Then along comes the duck curve. The duck curve has fundamentally changed the way the I still cough when I think about it. The way that the electric market operates, not just in California. This graph is generated by CAISO, the independent system operator in California. But again, what happens in California impacts everybody in the West. So if you look at this curve, you're steaming along with a load of about 20,000 megawatts, and then around 6 a.m., the sun starts to come up, and the wind starts to blow, and so all of a sudden you're generating all of this renewable energy. So you've got all of these other resources, generally coal-fired, some hydro, all of this sort of stuff, that basically they start backing down because you've got all of this energy being supplied by PV solar and all of this. And as you get down, you'll see this thing that they call overgeneration risk. There gets to a point where you start to worry about system stability and security because you only have the percentage of non-firm resources is so great that if the sun suddenly stops shining or the wind stops blowing, even for moments, it can impact the rest of your system because all of that fossil fuel stuff that you have can't respond quickly. And so that's why you see things called overgeneration risk. Is, you know, if suddenly the clouds roll in or the wind stops blowing, you could have a problem. And in fact, you see on May 16th of 2016, that the net load or the amount of resource that wasn't being handled by renewables was 11,000 megawatts. And, you know, at that time in 2016, at that point in time, there was 16,000 megawatts of load. So basically, you've got fully a third of your load being generated with solar that can go away at any point in time. Then here comes the next part. Now, as the sun starts to go down, that solar and wind starts to go away. Now you have to have resources that can ramp up quickly. And they talk here about a ramp need of 13,000 megawatts in 3 hours. What that's telling you is you have to have 13,000 megawatts of generating capacity sitting there and somehow get it from sitting there to absolutely full output in 3 hours. They do it generally with what they call quick start resources, which are projects like the one I have in Butte. But the other part of that equation is most of that resource is powered by natural gas. And you need to get that gas to the place to generate, and suddenly the gas is generated or is transported through a pipeline, and suddenly you have this huge draw on the gas pipe. And so it's creating issues associated with the gas pipeline. And so, you know, the question becomes, and they keep adding resources, renewable resources, more wind, more solar, those curves keep getting steeper. The other interesting part about this is price. What happens to the price in the market as all of this solar comes on? In fact, this happened again just a couple of weeks ago. Basically, the more solar you get in the middle of the day, it starts driving market prices of electricity down. And there's actually been instances where the price is negative. How can that be, say you? What that means is if I'm running a coal plant or a nuke plant or some resource that I want to keep running, then what I have to do is pay CAISO to take my electricity. So if the price is negative $10, then I'm paying them $10 a megawatt hour to take my electricity. So it's had a huge impact on the way the market operates. And the answer isn't perfect yet. Any stretch of the imagination. But as they keep adding resources and keep non-fossil fuel resources, it creates greater need for these quick start ramping resources that can make up the difference in the hours that the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. Questions, comments, smart remarks? That's all I have. I hope you learned something, anyway.
Good. What do you propose as some solutions to this? Yes, we do need to do this energy storage, but at the end of the day, if we're charging batteries or we're storing energy in some way, we still have to generate that through the combustion of hydrocarbons. From what I'm getting from you, and so how do we propose to and address all the issues that have come up today?
You know, if I were king, and there are times I think I am, turns out I'm not, but if I were king and I'm serious about this, I think back to, a lot of you guys in the room aren't old enough to remember this, but I think back to this country's pursuit of putting a man on the moon. And if you think about what this country spent to do that, all of those dollars, I believe, and I really believe this, are basically responsible for the world economy today. Because it was the investment. We said we were trying to put on the man on the moon, but all of the collateral technology that was developed to achieve that goal basically created today's economy. That's the truth. And I will, anybody who doesn't believe that, I will what did they say on the old John Wayne movie? I've said what I said and I'll defend it to the death. I believe that.
And that's the truth.
Yeah. And so if I were king, I would say, you know what? We got a lot of smart people in this country. You know what? We have a lot of coal in this country that's pretty easy to get to. And so I would create a moonshot for coal to turn it into the cleanest fuel ever. That's what I would do. Now, where that would lead you, I don't know. I honestly have no idea where that would do. Go ahead.
And so you're proposing that we still utilize coal, but increase the efficiency of how we turn it from coal to electricity? There's a lot of losses.
There's losses, and you can do coal gasification. Mm-hmm. The technology exists to turn coal into natural gas, and then it becomes much cleaner. The problem is today, natural gas prices are about $3 a million, $3.50 a million BTU. If I do coal gasification today, it's about $20 a million BTU. So the economics don't work. That's why it takes government. What I'm proposing is we need to focus, or the other extreme is get PV panels that can operate off of starlight. To me, what it takes is, you know, I gave the disclaimer at the beginning, I'm really not very smart, but there are a lot of smart people out there. And what we have to do is say, people get really upset when they read about the Green New Deal. It's something like that. And I'm not saying that you're going to convert everybody to green, but I have 7 children, soon to be 19 grandchildren. How many children and grandchildren they'll have, I don't know. I owe them something. And what I owe them is a good environment and a clean environment. That's what I owe. I was born and raised in Butte. I don't care. I happen to believe if you're born and raised in Butte, you can't help but be something of an environmentalist. All you got to do is look around. So we owe them something. And what we need to do is, like we did when we wanted to put a man on the moon, is to say, we're going to commit some funds to this, and this is the goal, and then stand back and watch what happens with collateral technology. I do have one easy fix for climate change, though, and this I can absolutely guarantee it will work. I happen to work for the Anaconda Company, and I was working for the Anaconda Company the night they showed up and shut off the pumps for the underground mining and basically stopped copper mining in Butte. So I moved on to the Montana Power Company, and I was working for the Montana Power Company when it did its boneheaded deal and stopped being the Montana Power Company in Butte. So the two oldest, you know, Wall Street companies in Montana, I killed them. You want to stop climate change, hire me. I'll stop them about a day.
So just kind of to respond to that, like what I'm getting from this is like a good view to what the market is doing right now. And like this is highlighting like how renewables have kind of tied into the grid that exists today and how those two compete. And I don't really have a question, but more of just like a statement and a thought that I wanted to share is like, this is a good segue to like challenge it and understand the supply chain of where your electricity comes from, where your fuel comes from, where your food comes from, because a lot of opportunities are going to come to light just by studying that. And so seeing like where like the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, like we're dependent currently with our current state on fossil fuels to step in and fill that void. And you're going to see a lot of similar parallels in a lot of other supply chains across our society. So kind of to follow up on your question earlier, like this is like a good thing behind the curtain to like look at that and see the opportunity of helping you decarbonize the supply chain. So that's just kind of a thought.
Yep, I agree.
Can you tell them how you did your plant, how you got it carbon neutral?
When I first got the idea to build a peaking plant in Butte, there's a whole process you have to go to, which involves the state and, you know, getting permits and all that. We didn't go to anybody first with respect to the state or the Public Service Commission or the utility. The first place we went was to the Montana Environmental Information Center. I sat down with Jim Jensen and Ann Hedges and Pat Judge at that time. We worked for them. And he said, look, here's what we want to do. Now, you don't necessarily have to agree with what we want to do, but I want you intimately involved in this process so that at the end of the day, we can sit down and figure out if there's a way we can accomplish what we want and you get what you want. But in order to do that, we have to agree on the facts. What's the impact of this? How is it going to be happen and all that? And they were good enough and kind enough to say, yeah, that makes sense to us. And so we went through the process, and they sat in basically on every meeting we had with the agencies and the permitting process, and they saw all the studies and all that. And then when we were all done, they said, look, we understand the need for this, we understand this, what we would like you to do is get carbon offsets for your facility to meet the Oregon standard. And so we said, okay, we're willing to do that. And so as part of our project, we funded a carbon offset program through the Oregon Climate Trust that said this money is to fund, to offset whatever carbon emissions we have so that you guys can do what you do to offset those emissions. And the only caveat we put on it was that whatever funds were spent had to be spent in the state of Montana. Our argument was the project is built in Montana, it's using Montana, it affects Montana people. Those carbon offset programs have to be spent in Montana, and they were. They did some fuels for schools programs and stuff like that. And so I always laugh when I hear people, just an editorial comment. I've been involved in coal projects, a lot of friends who are coal miners, I've operated nuclear power. You name it, the energy business, I've done it. Some people say, oh, you've got such varied experience. The reality is I couldn't hang on to a job. But, you know, I always think that the biggest enemy in the last 10 years to the coal companies have been the natural gas companies. And the reason I say that is, how many of you have seen ads on television? Natural gas, the clean fuel. And so, you know, that's kind of the deal. But you have to get people involved and give them some knowledge. Because otherwise, if people operate on belief alone, you're wasting your time. Yes.
Are you aware of any countries that you feel have a better national energy policy or things that are better balanced somehow?
There's a lot of people that talk a mean game. Let me answer it a different way. I know a lot of countries that have much worse energy policies, and a lot of them, I don't blame them. And the reason I say that is, if I am sitting in a third world country, and I have nothing to eat, or I'm struggling for a job, and somebody says, well, guess what? If I build this big coal, I worked on a coal plant in India, built a gas plant in Pakistan. And those people were thrilled to death that somebody was doing something about generation, because that to them was their opportunity for a greater lifestyle, a better life. And then you turn around and say, well, you know, you can't build that coal plant because of greenhouse gases. And their reaction always, and I don't blame them, is, now, wait a minute, what you're saying is you have yours, so now I can't have mine? And so that's the other part of why we need to figure this out, is to be able to say to people, you can in fact have your cake and eat it too. We aren't going to sit here from afar and demand that you do things that enhance our standard of living when you have no standard of living on your own. It's a tough situation. As far as renewables go, Norway's the best because they're 100% hydro.
So you're saying that we should give third world countries polluting sources of energy, or you're saying that we should put in the research and development to give them cleaner sources of energy?
I don't know how you don't let them pollute right now. I'm just being pragmatic. But I think as part of that, we as a country have an obligation to try to find ways to clean up those as well. I mean, if that's what we want, if we want a better world, we've got an economy that should be able to support that to some degree. You know, and I recognize that's Pollyannish, especially today. But the fact of the matter is, we're in a position to do that. And we're not the only country of wealth that could do that. But that's part and parcel. And until then, we simply can't forbid them the opportunity to use indigenous fuels to help themselves get a better life. Because if they do that, they're going to start. China's a good example. China was horrible for coal. But now as their economy has gotten better and the standard of living has moved up, they're throttling back their coal. You know, it's perfect is the enemy of good. And what we need is to strive for the solutions, strive for perfection, but accept good. And not, I don't mean good enough, close enough for government. I mean good.